4.1 The housing policy set forth in the Barnard College Student Handbook stated that all out-of-town freshmen were required to live in one of the on-campus dormitories, whereas freshmen from New York could choose between living in a dormitory and living at home with their parents. Independent Amy, who had no desire to stay with her parents, and no desire to share a room with someone in an overregulated dormitory, outfoxed the system by claiming her parents had moved from West 75th Street to a bigger apartment on West 111th Street, a much bigger apartment that was in fact occupied by four students who were not freshmen, a sophomore and a junior from Barnard, and a junior and a senior from Columbia. And when Amy moved into that immense place with the long corridors and ancient plumbing fixtures and beveled glass doorknobs, she became the sole occupant of the fifth bedroom. Her parents went along with the deception because Amy had shown them the numbers, which proved that it was cheaper to pay one-fifth of the $270 apartment rent than to live in a dormitory. And also because, and especially because, they knew it was time for their willful daughter to leave home. A little more than a year had passed since the cookout in the Ferguson's backyard, and now the Schneiderman's daughter and the Ferguson's son had been granted their most ardent wish, a room with a lock on the door and a chance to fall asleep together in the same bed whenever they wanted to. The problem was that whenever turned out to be a sticky concept, more an idealized possibility than a workable proposition. And with one of them still stuck in Montclair, and the other caught in the whirl of confusions and adjustments that come with the start of college life, they wound up sharing that bed less often than they had expected. There were the weekends, of course, and they took advantage of them whenever they could, which was most weekends in September, October, and early November. But the freedoms of the summer had been curtailed, and only once in all that time was Ferguson able to make one of his weeknight dashes into the city. They continued to talk about the things they had always talked about, which that fall included such matters as the Warren Commission report, true or false, the free speech movement at Berkeley, long live Mario Savio, and the victory of the bad Johnson over the infinitely worse Goldwater. Not three cheers, but two, perhaps one. But then Amy was invited on a weekend outing to Connecticut, and they had to cancel their plans, which was followed by another cancellation the next week. A touch of the flu, she said, although she wasn't in the apartment when he called her on Saturday night and again on Sunday afternoon. And bit by bit, Ferguson sensed that she was slipping away from him. His old fears returned, the black ruminations of last winter, when he thought she might have to leave New York, conjuring up the other people she would come to know in those imagined other places. The other boys, the other loves, and why should it be any different in her home city? She was living in a new world now, and he belonged to the old world she had left behind. Just 36 blocks to the north, and yet the customs were entirely different up there, and the people spoke another language. It wasn't that she seemed bored with him or loved him any less. It wasn't that her body stiffened up when he touched her, or that she wasn't happy with him in the new bed in the new apartment. It was simply that she seemed distracted now, unable to focus her attention on him as she had in the past. After those two missed weekends, he managed to arrange a visit to the empty apartment on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. Her roommates had all gone home for the holiday, and as they sat in the kitchen together, drinking wine and smoking cigarettes, he noticed that Amy was looking out the window instead of looking at him. And rather than ignore it and go on with what he was saying, he stopped in mid-sentence and asked her if something was wrong. And that was when it happened. That was when Amy turned her head back in his direction, looked him in the eyes, and pronounced the seven small words that had been forming in her mind for close to a month. "I think I need a break, Archie." They were only 17 years old, she said, and it was beginning to feel as if they were married, as if they had no future anymore except to go on being together. And even if they did wind up together in the long run, it was too soon to lock themselves into that commitment now. They would feel smothered, trapped by promises they might not be able to keep, and before long they would start to resent each other, and why not take a deep breath and just relax for a little while? Ferguson knew he was being dumb, but there was only one question his dumb heart could think of asking. Are you saying you don't love me anymore? You haven't been listening to me, Archie, Amy said. All I'm saying is that we need more air in the room. I want us to keep the doors and windows open. Which means that you've fallen for someone else. Which means that someone has his eye on me and I've flirted with him a couple of times. It's nothing serious, believe me. In fact, I'm not even sure I like him. But the point is that I don't want to feel guilty about it. And I have been feeling guilty because I don't want to hurt you. And then I asked myself, what's wrong with you, Amy? You're not married to Archie. You're not even halfway through your first year of college. And why shouldn't you have a chance to explore a little? To kiss another boy if you want to. Maybe even go to bed with another boy if you feel like it. To do the kinds of things people are supposed to do when they're young. Because it would kill me, that's why. It isn't forever, Archie. All I'm asking for is a time out. They went on talking for more than an hour, and then Ferguson left the apartment and drove back to Montclair. 4.5 months would go by before he saw Amy again. 4.5 dreary months of no kissing, no touching, and no talking to the one person he most wanted to kiss and touch and talk to. But Ferguson managed to weather that time without going to pieces because he was convinced that he and Amy had not come to the end. That the long and complicated journey they had embarked on together had merely run into its first detour, a rock slide that had fallen onto their path and had forced them to head off into the woods, where they had momentarily lost sight of each other, but sooner or later they would find the road again and continue on their way. He was convinced of this because he had taken Amy at her word, for Amy was the one person he had ever known who didn't lie, couldn't lie. Who always told the truth, no matter what the circumstances. And when she'd said that she wasn't dumping him or sending him into permanent exile, that all she was asking for was a break, pause to open the windows and air out the room, Ferguson had believed her. The strength of that belief kept him going through those empty, aimless months. And he hunkered down and tried to make the best of them, refusing to succumb to the temptations of self-pity, which had been so attractive to him at earlier stages of his adolescence. The loss of Anne-Marie Dumartin, the injury to his hand, striving for a tougher, more resolute approach to the conundrums of pain. The pain of disappointment, the pain of living in Mr. Martino's world of shit. Girding himself to absorb blows now, rather than crumbling under their force. Standing his ground rather than running away. Digging in for what he now understood would be a long siege of trench warfare. Late November 1964 to mid-April 1965. A time of no sex and no love. A time of inwardness and disembodied solitude. A time of forcing himself at long last to grow up, to have done with everything that still connected him to his childhood. It was his last year of high school, the last year he would spend in the town of Montclair, New Jersey, the last year he would live under the same roof with his parents, the last year of the first part of his life. And now that he was alone again, Ferguson looked out at his old familiar world with renewed concentration and intensity. For even as he kept his gaze fixed on the people and places he had known for the past 14 years, he felt they were already beginning to vanish before his eyes, slowly dissolving like a Polaroid image moving in reverse, undeveloping itself as the outlines of buildings blurred and the features of his friends' faces grew less distinct and the bright colors faded into white rectangles of nothingness. He was among his classmates again, as he hadn't been in over a year, no longer slinking off to New York on the weekends, no longer a person with a secret life, a one-thumbed shadow reinserted into the midst of the 17 and 18-year-olds he had known since the age of 3 and 4 and 5. And now that they were beginning to disappear, he found himself looking at them with something close to tenderness. The same boring suburban crowd he had turned his back on so abruptly after Amy went upstairs with him on the afternoon of the Labor Day cookout were his sole companions again, and he did what he could to treat them with tolerance and respect, even the most ridiculous and empty-headed among them, for he was no longer in the judgment business. He had given up his compulsion to hunt out the flaws and weaknesses in others, because he had learned by now that he was just as weak and flawed as they were. And if he meant to grow up into the kind of person he was expecting himself to be, he would have to keep his mouth shut and his eyes open and never look down on anyone again. No Amy for now, no Amy for what threatened to be a long and unbearable stretch of time. But Ferguson's irrational conviction that the two of them were destined to be together again at some point in the future pushed him into making plans for that future when the moment came for him to send off his applications to college. That was one of the curious things about being in the last year of high school, the fact that you spent most of your time thinking about next year, knowing that a part of you was already gone, even as you remained where you were, as if you were living in two places at once, the drab present and the uncertain future. Boiling down your existence into a set of numbers that included your grade point average and SAT scores, approaching the teachers you liked best and asking them to write letters of recommendation for you, composing the absurd, impossible essay about yourself in which you hoped to impress a panel of anonymous strangers of your worthiness to attend their institution, then putting on a jacket and tie and traveling to that institution to be interviewed by someone whose report would weigh heavily on whether they accepted you or not. And suddenly, Ferguson started worrying about his hand again. For the first time in months, he felt anxious about his missing fingers when he sat down across from the man who would help to decide his future. Asking himself whether the man saw him as a handicapped person or merely as someone who had been in an accident. And then, even as he was replying to the man's questions, he remembered the last time he and Amy had talked about his hand, back in the summer, when for some reason he had looked down at it and said how much it revolted him, which had annoyed her so greatly that she'd shouted at him, saying that if he ever mentioned his hand again, she would take out a cleaver and chop off her own left thumb and give it to him as a present. And the ferocity of her anger was so magnificent that he promised never to bring up the subject again. And as he went on talking to the man who was interviewing him, he realized that not only must he not talk about it again, but he must not think about it either. And bit by bit, he forced himself to push it out of his mind and settled into his conversation with the man, who was a music professor at Columbia, which, needless to say, was his first choice, the only college he had any interest in attending. And when the genial, humorous, thoroughly sympathetic composer of 12-tone comic operas found out that Ferguson was interested in poetry and hoped he'd become a writer one day, he walked over to the bookshelf in his office and pulled out 4 recent issues of the Columbia Review, the undergraduate literary magazine, and handed them to the nervous, self-conscious applicant from the other side of the Hudson. "You might want to have a look at these," the professor said, and then they were shaking hands and saying goodbye to each other, and as Ferguson left the building and walked out onto the campus, which was already familiar to him because of his half-dozen weekend trysts with Lady Schneiderman back in the fall, he wondered if he might not run into her that afternoon. He didn't. Or if he shouldn't go down to her apartment on West 111th Street and ring the bell. He didn't, he wouldn't, he couldn't. And so, rather than torment himself with thoughts about his absent, inaccessible love, he opened one of the issues of the Columbia Review and stumbled across a poem with a most amusing and vulgar refrain, a line so shocking in its directness that Ferguson laughed out loud when he read it. "A steady fuck is good for you." It might not have been much of a poem, but Ferguson couldn't help agreeing with the sentiment, which contained a truth that no other poem had ever expressed so bluntly, or at least no other poem he had read. And on top of that, he found it encouraging to know that Columbia was a place that allowed its students to publish such thoughts without fear of being censored, which meant that one could be free as a student there. For if any student had written that line for the Montclair High School literary magazine, he would have been expelled at once and likely thrown in jail. His parents were indifferent. Neither one of them had gone to college. Neither one of them knew anything about the distinctions between one college and another, and therefore they would be happy for their boy wherever he went, whether to the State University of New Brunswick, Rutgers, or to Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Since they were too ignorant to have developed into snobs about the prestige of one school over another, and were simply proud of Ferguson for having been such a good student all his life. Aunt Mildred, however, who had recently been promoted to full professor at Berkeley, had other ideas about the academic destination of her one and only. And in a long coast-to-coast phone call in early December, she tried to steer her nephew around to her way of thinking. Columbia was an excellent first choice, she said. No problem with that. The undergraduate program was one of the strongest in the country. But she also wanted him to consider other options. Amherst and Oberlin, for example. Small, isolated schools where the atmosphere would be calmer and less distracting than in New York, more conducive to the rigors of focused study. But if he had his heart set on a big university, why not give some thought to Stanford and Berkeley? How dearly she would love to have him out in California with her for the next 4 years, and either one of those places was every bit as good as Columbia, if not better. But Ferguson told her that his mind was made up. It was New York or nothing. And if Columbia turned him down, he would go to NYU, which accepted nearly everyone who applied. And if something went wrong there, his high school diploma would allow him to enroll in courses at the new school, which turned down no one. And that was the plan, he said. Just three possibilities, all of them in New York. And when his aunt asked him why it had to be New York when there were so many more attractive places to choose from, Ferguson reached back into his memory and pulled out the words Amy had spoken to him on the first day they met. Because, he said, New York is it. A state of limbo, perhaps, but in the narrow slit between the not here and not there of the drab present, something happened to Ferguson that altered his thinking about what would happen next. In early December, he landed a job at the Montclair Times, which more accurately could be said to have been a job that landed on him, since it came his way unexpectedly, with no serious effort on his part, a gift of blind happenstance. But once he started doing it, he discovered that he wanted to keep on doing it. For not only did he enjoy the work, but the effect of that enjoyment was to narrow the infinite spaces of a future anywhere into a precise somewhere. And with that narrowing, a multitude of anythings was suddenly turned into a single something. In other words, 3 months short of his 18th birthday, Ferguson accidentally stumbled upon a calling in life, something to do over the long haul. And the perplexing thing was that it never would have occurred to him to do it if he hadn't been thrust into doing it in the first place. The Montclair Times was a weekly newspaper that had been covering local events since 1877. And since Montclair was larger than most of the towns in the area, population 44,000, the paper was more substantial, more thorough, and carried more advertising than other Essex County weeklies, even if most of the stories it published were more or less the same as those found in the smaller rags, Board of Education meetings, gatherings of the Ladies' Garden Club, Boy Scout banquets, automobile accidents, engagements and marriages, break-ins, muggings, and acts of teenage vandalism, as reported in the police blotter, reviews of exhibitions at the Montclair Art Museum, lectures at Montclair State Teachers College, and sports in all of their indigenous manifestations, Little League baseball, Pop Warner football, and extensive coverage of the games played by the high school varsity teams, the redoubtable Montclair Mounties, whose football squad had just finished the most successful season in its history, a perfect 9-0 record, a state championship, and a number 3 ranking in the country, which meant that of all the thousands of high school football teams spread across the United States, only 2 were considered to be better than Montclair. Ferguson had missed every one of those Saturday games, but now, just 10 days after his glum post-Thanksgiving conversation with Amy, his mother told him about a possible opening at the Times, assuming he was interested. It seemed that Rick Vogel, the young man who reported on high school sports for the paper, had done such an impressive job chronicling the football team's glorious season that he had been hired away by the Newark Evening News, a daily paper with 20 times the circulation of the Montclair Weekly, and a large enough budget to pay 20 times the salary. And the editor-in-chief of the Times found himself in what Ferguson's mother called a hell of a fix. The varsity basketball season was scheduled to begin next Tuesday, and he had no one to write about the games. Until then, the thought of working for a newspaper had never crossed Ferguson's mind. He saw himself as a literary man, a man whose future would be dedicated to the writing of books. Whether he wound up becoming a novelist or a playwright or the heir to New Jersey's Walt Whitman and William Carlos Williams, he was headed in the direction of art. And whatever the importance of newspapers, it was certain that writing for them had nothing to do with art. On the other hand, an opportunity had presented itself to him. He was at loose ends, restless and dissatisfied with just about everything, and perhaps a stint at the Times would inject some color into the drab present and lure him away from dwelling on his own miserable circumstances. More than that, there was some money involved, a nominal $10 fee per article. But even more than the money, there was the fact that the Times was a legitimate newspaper, not a joke publication like the Mountaineer at Montclair High, and if Ferguson managed to wrangle himself a job there, he would be entering the ranks of the grown-up world, no longer an almost 18-year-old high school boy, but a young adult, or, just as good if not more satisfying to his ears, a boy wonder, meaning a boy who was doing the work of a man. Not to be forgotten was that Whitman had started out as a journalist for the Brooklyn Eagle, and that Hemingway had written for the Kansas City Star, and that Newark-born Stephen Crane had been a reporter for the New York Herald. And so when Ferguson's mother asked him if he had any interest in taking over for the precipitously departed Vogel, Ferguson needed no more than a half a minute to say yes. It wasn't going to be easy, his mother added, but Edward Imhoff, the fat sourpuss who edited the Times, might be desperate enough to chance going with an untested kid, at least for one game, which would buy him a little time if Ferguson didn't pan out. But as they both knew, his mother said, he was going to pan out. And because she had been publishing photographs in Imhoff's paper for more than a dozen years and had included his portrait in her book of Garden State Notables, an act of uncalled-for generosity, if there ever was one, the windbag owed her, she said. And without wasting another second, she picked up the phone and called him. Such was the way Ferguson's mother handled herself when something needed to be done. She seized the moment and did it, unafraid and unstoppable. And how Ferguson relished her gutsy bravura as he listened to her half of the conversation with Imhoff. Not once in the 7 minutes they talked did she sound like a mother begging a favor for a son. She was a clever talent scout who had just solved a problem for an old friend, and Imhoff should get on his knees and thank her for saving his ass. On the strength of that call, Ferguson was granted an audience with the moody, dyspeptic editor-in-chief, and although he came armed with two samples of his writing in order to prove that he was not an illiterate numbskull, an English paper on King Lear, and a short, jocular poem that ended with the lines, "If life is a dream, what happens when I wake up?" The bulbous, balding Imhoff barely glanced at them. "I assume you know something about basketball," he said, "and I assume you can write a coherent sentence. But what about newspapers? Do you even bother to read them?" "Of course he read them," Ferguson replied. "Three papers every day. The Star Ledger for local news, the New York Times for world and national news, and the Herald Tribune because it had the best writers." "The best?" Imhoff said, "and who, in your opinion, are the best?" "Jimmy Breslin on politics for one, Red Smith on sports for another, and the music critic Gilbert Schneiderman, who happens to be the uncle of a close friend of mine." "Bully for you. And how many newspaper articles have you written, Mr. Hotshot?" "I think you already know the answer to that question." Ferguson didn't care, not about what Imhoff thought of him, and not even if Imhoff turned him down for the job. His mother's boldness had emboldened him into a position of absolute indifference, and indifference had power, Ferguson realized, and no matter what the outcome of the interview, he wasn't going to let himself be pushed around by that bilious sack of haughtiness and bad manners. "Give me one good reason why I should hire you," Imhoff said. "Because you need someone to cover the game on Tuesday night, and I'm willing to do it. If you didn't want me to do it, Why would you be wasting your precious time talking to me now? 600 words, Imov said, as he slapped his palms against the desk. You fuck up and you're out. You cut the mustard and you get to live another day. Writing a newspaper article was going to be different from any other kind of writing Ferguson had done in the past. Not just the writing of poems and short stories, which were so different from journalism they didn't even belong in the conversation, but also the other forms of nonfiction writing he had been engaged in for most of his life. Personal letters, which sometimes reported on real events, but were predominantly filled with opinions about himself and others. I love you, I hate you, I'm sad, I'm happy, our friend turns out to be a despicable liar. And papers for school, such as his recent essay on King Lear, which was essentially a group of words responding to another group of words, as was the case with nearly all scholarly endeavors, words responding to words. By contrast, a newspaper article was a group of words responding to the world, an attempt to put the unwritten world into words. And in order to tell the story of an event that had occurred in the real world, you paradoxically had to begin with the last thing that had happened rather than the first. The effect rather than the cause. Not George Blifil woke up yesterday morning with a stomachache, but George Blifil died last night at age 77. With something about the stomachache 2 or 3 paragraphs down. The facts above all else, and the most important fact before all other facts. But just because you had to stick to the facts didn't mean you were supposed to stop thinking or weren't allowed to use your imagination, as Red Smith had done earlier that year when reporting on the defeat of Sonny Liston for the heavyweight title. Quote, Cassius Marcellus Clay fought his way out of the horde that swarmed and leaped and shouted in the ring, climbed like a squirrel onto the red velvet ropes, and brandished his steel-gloved hand aloft. Eat your words, he howled to the working press rows. Eat your words. Just because you were confined to the real world didn't make you any less of a writer if you had it in you to write well. Ferguson knew that sports were of no consequence in the long run, but they lent themselves to the written word more readily than most other subjects because each game had a built-in narrative structure. The agon of competition necessarily resulted in a victory for one team and a defeat for the other. And Ferguson's job was to tell the story of how the winner won and the loser lost, whether by 1 point or by 20 points. And when he showed up for the first game of the season on that Tuesday night in mid-December, he had already figured out how he was going to shape his story. Since the central drama of the Montclair basketball team that year was the youth and inexperience of its players. Not one member of the starting five had been a starter last season. 8 seniors had graduated in June, and with one exception, the current squad was composed entirely of sophomores and juniors. That would be the thread that ran through his coverage of the team from game to game, Ferguson decided. Charting whether a collection of raw beginners would evolve into a solid unit as the season unfolded or simply stagger along from one defeat to the next. And even though Imhoff had promised to boot him out if the first article failed to deliver the goods, Ferguson wasn't planning to fail. He most emphatically was not going to fail. And therefore, he looked upon that first article as the opening chapter of a saga he would go on writing until the season ended, after the 18th game in mid-February. What he hadn't expected was how inordinately alive he would feel when he walked into the school gym and took a seat beside the official scorer at the table that straddled the midcourt line. Everything was suddenly different. No matter how many games he had seen in that gym over the years, no matter how many physical education classes he had attended there since entering high school, no matter how many indoor practice sessions he had taken part in there as a varsity baseball player, the gym was no longer the same gym that evening. It had been transformed into a site of potential words, the words he would write about the game that had just begun. And because it was his job to write those words, he had to look at what was happening more closely than he had ever looked at anything. And the sheer attentiveness and singularity of purpose that sort of looking required seemed to lift him up and fill his veins with massive jolts of electric current. The hair on his head was sizzling. His eyes were wide open, and he felt more alive than he had in weeks, alive and alert, all lit up and awake in the moment. He had a pocket-sized notebook with him, and all through the game he jotted down what he was seeing on the hardwood court. For long stretches he found himself seeing and writing simultaneously. The pressure to translate the unwritten world into written words was pulling out the words with surprising quickness. It was utterly unlike the slow, brooding agonies that went into writing a poem. All was speed now, all was haste, and almost without thinking about it, he was writing down words such as, quote, a short, red-headed ball handler with the quickness of a hamster, and a skinny rebounding machine with elbows as deadly as sharpened pencils, and a foul shot that fluttered in and out of the rim like an indecisive hummingbird. And then, after Montclair fell to Bloomfield in a, quote, closely fought 54-51 defeat, Ferguson concluded the story with, the Mountie faithful, unaccustomed to losing after an autumn of football perfection, shuffled out of the gym in silence. The article was due the following morning, so Ferguson rushed back home in the white Impala and went up to his room, where he spent the next 3 hours writing and rewriting the piece, whittling down the 800-word first draft to 650 words and then down to 597, just under Imhoff's limit, which he typed up in a final typo-free version on his Olympia portable, the indomitable German-made machine his parents had given him on his 15th birthday. Assuming Imhoff accepted the article, it would be the first bit of writing Ferguson had ever published outside of school magazines. And as he faced the imminent loss of his authorial virginity, he dithered back and forth about what name he should use to sign his work. Archie and Archibald had always posed a problem for him. Archie, because of that damnable idiot in the comic books, Archie Andrews, the friend of Jughead and Moose, the bird-brained teenager who could never decide whether he loved the blonde-haired Betty more than the dark-haired Veronica, or vice versa. And Archibald, because it was a fusty, old-fangled embarrassment that was all but defunct now. And the only literary man known as Archibald anywhere in the world was Ferguson's least favorite American poet, Archibald MacLeish, who won every prize and was considered to be a national treasure, but was in fact a boring, no-talent dud. Except for his long-dead great-uncle, whom Ferguson had never met, the sole Archie Archibald he felt any kinship with was Cary Grant, who had been born in England as Archibald Leach. But no sooner had the showman acrobat come to America than he changed his name and turned himself into a Hollywood film star, which never would have happened if he had stuck with the name of Archibald. Ferguson liked being Archie to his friends and family. There was nothing wrong with Archie when he heard it in the intimate discourses of affection and love. But there was something juvenile and even laughable about Archie in a public context, especially for a writer. And because Archibald Ferguson was not to be considered under any circumstances, the almost 18-year-old budding newspaper man decided to suppress his name altogether and go with his initials, in the same way T.S. Eliot and H.L. Mencken had done with theirs, and thus the career of A.I. Ferguson began. AI, known to some as a field of study called artificial intelligence. But there were other references buried in those letters as well. Among them, Anonymous Insider, which was the one Ferguson chose to think about whenever he saw his new name in print. Because he had to go to school the next morning, his mother agreed to stop in at Imhoff's office and give him the article herself, since her studio was only 2 blocks from the Times building in downtown Montclair. A day of anxious breathing followed. Would Ferguson be let in the door or shut out? Would he be asked to cover Friday night's game, or was his job as a basketball reporter finished after one game? For now that he had taken the plunge, he was no longer indifferent, and pretending that he didn't care would have been a lie. 6.5 hours of school, and then the drive to Roseland Photo for the verdict, which his mother delivered with a certain dose of bemused irony. "It's all okay, Archie," she said, getting down to the most important fact first. He's running your story in tomorrow's paper, and you're hired for the rest of the basketball season, and the baseball season too, if that's what you want. But good God, what a piece of work that man is, humping and grumping as I stood there watching him read your article, pouncing on your new pen name, first of all, which I like a lot, by the way, but he couldn't get over what he called the pretentiousness of it. AI, 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 he kept saying it over and over. And then he would add, asshole intellectual, arrogant imbecile, absolute ignoramus. He couldn't stop himself from insulting you because he realized what you'd written was good, Archie, unexpectedly good. And a man like that doesn't want to encourage young people. He wants to crush them. So he picked up a couple of things just to show how superior he is to everyone else. The remark about the indecisive hummingbird, he just hated that one and crossed it out with his blue pencil. And a couple of other things made him snort or curse under his breath. But the upshot is that you're a working member of the local press now, or, in Ed Imhoff's words, when I asked him whether he wanted you or not, the boy will do. The boy will do? I burst out laughing when I heard that, and then I asked him, is that all you have to say, Ed? To which he answered, isn't that enough? Well, maybe you'd like to thank me for finding you a new reporter, I said. Thank you, he said. No, my dear Rose, it's you who should be thanking me. One way or another, Ferguson was in the door, and the good thing about the arrangement was that he rarely had to see or talk to Imhoff. Since he was required to be at school on Wednesday and Monday mornings, the respective deadlines for the articles about the Tuesday and Friday night games, which were published together when the paper came out on Thursday afternoon. Ferguson's mother therefore continued to hand in the pieces to Imhoff, and although Ferguson went in twice for Saturday meetings with the big fish in a small pond to be dressed down for the sin of overwriting, if phrases such as existential despair and a balletic move that challenged the principles of Newtonian physics could be considered overwriting, most of his conversations with Imhoff took place on the telephone, as when the boss asked him to do a feature-length profile of the basketball coach, Jack McNulty, after the team won 6 in a row to lift its record to 9-7, or when he instructed Ferguson to start wearing a jacket and tie to the games because he was, quote, a representative of the Montclair Times and needed to comport himself as a gentleman while carrying out his duties. As if wearing a jacket and tie had anything to do with writing about basketball games. But those were the days when questions of clothing and hair had begun to divide the old and the young. And like many of the boys in his school, Ferguson had let his hair grow longer that year. The old 1950s crew cuts were passé now, and changes were happening among the girls as well. More and more of them had stopped teasing their hair into the cotton candy bouffants and beehives of yore, and were simply brushing it out and letting it hang loosely around their shoulders, which Ferguson found far more attractive and sexy. And as he studied the human landscape in those early weeks of 1965, he felt that everyone was starting to look better. There was something in the air that pleased him. On February 7th, 8 American soldiers were killed and 126 wounded in a Viet Cong attack against a military base in Pleiku, and the bombing of North Vietnam began. 2 weeks later, on February 21st, just days after the end of the high school basketball season, Malcolm X was gunned down by Nation of Islam assassins while delivering a speech at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights. Those are the only two subjects that seem to exist anymore, Ferguson wrote in a letter to his aunt and uncle in California. The expanding bloodshed in Vietnam and the civil rights movement at home. White America at war with the yellow people of Southeast Asia. White America in conflict with its own black citizens, who were more and more in conflict with themselves, for the movement that had already split into factions was splitting further into factions of factions, and perhaps even factions of factions of factions. Everyone in conflict with everyone else, the lines drawn so sharply that few dared step over them anymore. And so divided had the world become that when Ferguson innocently asked Rhonda Williams out on a date sometime in January, he discovered that those lines were now sheathed in barbed wire. This was the same Rhonda Williams he had known for the past 10 years, the slender, talkative girl who was in most of his academic classes and who happened not to be a white person, but a black person, as were many other students at Montclair High, which was the most racially integrated school in the area, a segment of northern New Jersey in which every one of the surrounding schools was nearly all white or nearly all black. And Rhonda Williams, whose family was wealthier than Ferguson's, and who happened to have black skin, which in truth was pale brown skin, just one or two shades darker than Ferguson's skin, vivacious Rhonda Williams, who was the daughter of the chief of internal medicine at the VA hospital in nearby Orange, and whose younger brother was a substitute guard on the Montclair basketball team, bright, college-bound Rhonda Williams, who had always been Ferguson's friend and shared his love of music, was consequently the first person who sprang to mind when he read that Sviatoslav Richter would be performing an all-Schubert program at the Mosque Theater in Newark the Saturday after next. And so he asked Rhonda if she would like to go with him, not just because he thought she would enjoy the concert, but because it had been 2 months since he had last seen Amy, and he was aching for female companionship, longing to be with someone who was not a basketball player or Bobby George or odious Edward Imhoff. And of all the girls in his school, Rhonda was the one he liked best. The prospect of an early Saturday night meal at the Claremont Diner, and then Schubert played by one of the world's finest pianists, struck Ferguson as something no music lover would want to turn down. But incredibly enough, she did turn him down. And when Ferguson asked why, Rhonda said, "I just can't, Archie." "Does that mean you have a boyfriend I don't know about?" "No, there's no boyfriend. I just can't." "But why? If you're not busy that night, what's the problem?" "I'd rather not say." "Come on, Rhonda, that's not fair. This is me, remember? Your old friend Archie. You're smart enough to figure it out for yourself." "No, I'm not. I can't even begin to guess what you're talking about." "Because you're white, that's why. Because you're white and I'm black." "Is that a reason?" "I think it is." "I'm not asking you to marry me. I just want to go to a concert with you." "I know, and I appreciate your asking me, but I can't." "Please tell me it's because you don't like me. That I can accept. But I do like you, Archie. You know that. I've always liked you." "Do you realize what you're saying?" "Of course I do." "It's the end of the world, Rhonda." "No, it's not. It's the beginning of a new world, and you just have to accept it." Whether it was the end of the world or the beginning of the world, Ferguson would never bring himself to accept it. And he walked away from that conversation feeling both sucker-punched and angry, appalled that such a conversation could still have been possible 100 years after the end of the Civil War. He wanted to talk to someone about it, to pour out the 1,000 reasons why he was so upset by what had happened. But the only person he had ever been able to open up to about such things was Amy, and Amy was the one person he couldn't talk to now. And as for his friends at school, there was no one he trusted deeply enough to confide in anymore. And even Bobby, who still rode to school with him every morning and continued to regard himself as Ferguson's staunchest pal, wouldn't have had much to contribute to a discussion of that sort. And besides, Bobby was having problems of his own just then. Love problems of the most devastating adolescent variety, an unrequited crush on Margaret O'Mara, who herself had had a crush on Ferguson for the past 6 years, which was now causing no end of trouble and consternation for Ferguson, since immediately after his post-Thanksgiving talk with Amy, he had toyed with the idea of asking Margaret out on a date. Not that he had any burning desire to become entangled with Margaret, who was a dull, friendly girl with an uncommonly attractive face, but after Amy had declared her interest in kissing other boys, Ferguson had wondered, not without some bitterness, whether he shouldn't respond by going out to look for other girls to kiss, and Margaret O'Mara was a prime candidate because he felt almost certain she would want to be kissed by him. But then, just as he was preparing himself to call her, Bobby had confessed how enamored he was of the same Margaret O'Mara, who was the first monumental love of his life. But she seemed to have no interest in him. She barely even listened when he talked to her, and would Ferguson kindly intercede on his behalf and explain to Margaret what a good and worthy fellow he was? Shades of Cyrano de Bergerac, a film that Ferguson and Margaret had seen together in their 10th grade French class. And so, when Ferguson went to Margaret and tried to put in a word for Bobby, instead of asking her out himself, she laughed at him and called him Cyrano. The laugh was the end of it, resulting in a double washout, failure on both fronts. Bobby was still pining for her, and even though Margaret would have leapt at the chance to go out with Ferguson, Ferguson had resolved not to ask her out because he couldn't do that to his friends, which led to no dates with anyone for the next 2 months. And then, when he did ask someone out, it was Rhonda Williams, who politely kicked him in the face and taught him that the America he wanted to live in didn't exist, and probably never would. Under different circumstances, he might have gone to his mother and talked out his frustrations with her. But he was feeling too old for that now, and he didn't want to depress her with a long emotional rant about the bleak future he envisioned for the Republic. His parents' future was already bleak enough, and with income dwindling from both Roseland Photo and Stanley's TV and radio, and with a supplemental $15,000 all but exhausted now, drastic changes were imminent. It was only a matter of time before the family would have to rethink how it lived and worked, and perhaps even where it lived and where it worked. Ferguson felt especially sorry for his father, whose small retail business could no longer compete with the large discount stores that were popping up in towns such as Livingston, West Orange, and Short Hills. And why would anyone want to buy a television from Ferguson's father when the same set could be found for 40% less at E.J. Corvette's just a few miles away? When Mike Antonelli was let go in the second week of January, Ferguson understood that the store was on its last legs. But still, his father persisted in maintaining the old routine, arriving at 9 sharp every morning to install himself at his workbench in the back room, where he continued to repair broken toasters and badly functioning vacuum cleaners, more and more reminding Ferguson of old Dr. Manette from A Tale of Two Cities, the half-deranged prisoner of the Bastille who sat at the bench in his cell, cobbling shoes. Year after year, cobbling shoes. Year after year, fixing damaged household appliances. And more, Ferguson came to acknowledge the incontestable fact that his father had never fully recovered from Arnold's betrayal, that his faith in the family had been destroyed. And then, in the ruins of his crumbled certainties, the one person in the family he still loved had crashed her car into a tree and maimed his son for life. And even though he never talked about the accident, both Ferguson and his mother knew that he rarely stopped thinking about it. The fortunes of Roseland Photo were also sinking, not as quickly as those of Stanley's TV and radio, perhaps, but Ferguson's mother knew the days of studio photography were nearly done. And for some time, she had been reducing the number of hours she kept the studio open, from 5 10-hour days in 1953 to 5 8-hour days in 1956, to 4 8-hour days in 1959, to 4 6-hour days in 1961, to 3 6-hour days in 1962, to 3 4-hour days in 1963, devoting more and more of her energies to photo work for Imhoff at the Montclair Times, where she had been put on salary as the paper's chief photographer. But then her book of Garden State Notables was published in February 1965, and within 2 months the book had landed in the waiting rooms of most doctors' offices, dentists' offices, lawyers' offices, and municipal offices around the state. And Rose Ferguson was no longer an invisible no one, but a recognizable someone. And on the strength of her success with the book, she decided to go to the editor of the Newark Star-Ledger, whose picture was in the book, and ask for a job as a staff photographer. For even though Ferguson's mother was 43 by then, too old perhaps, to most people she looked 6 or 8 years younger than that. And as the editor scanned the contents of her voluminous portfolio and remembered the flattering portrait she had taken of him, which was hanging on a wall in his den at home, he suddenly reached out and shook her hand. For the fact was that they did have an opening, and Rose Ferguson was just as qualified to fill that slot as anyone else. The salary wasn't much, more or less the same amount she had managed to cobble together with studio portraits and her work with Imhoff in an average year, which would neither hurt nor help the family's overall financial situation. But then Ferguson's father came up with the bright idea of shutting down Stanley's TV and radio, which had been running in the red for the past 3 years, and a negative was turned into a positive, which became slightly more positive when Sam Brownstein talked him into accepting a job at his sporting goods store in Newark, or, as Ferguson's father put it, in one of his rare moments of levity, trading in air conditioners for catcher's gloves. And thus, in the spring of 1965, both Roseland Photo and Stanley's TV and Radio closed their doors for good. And with Ferguson about to go off to college in the fall, his parents said it was time to start thinking about selling the house and renting a smaller place closer to their new jobs, which would free up more than enough money to cover Ferguson's college expenses, since for some reason Ferguson's father was opposed to the idea of asking for a scholarship. Stupid pride or proud stupidity? Or reducing the burden by taking part in a work-study program because, as his father explained, he didn't want his boy to work while he studied, but to work at his studies. And when Ferguson protested that his father was being absurd, his mother walked over to his father, kissed him on the cheek, and said, "No, Archie, you're the one who's absurd." Ferguson's birthday fell on a Wednesday that year. He was 18 now, which gave him the right to drink alcohol in any bar or restaurant in New York City, to marry without his parents' consent, to die for his country, to be judged as a man in a court of law, but not to vote in municipal, state, or federal elections. The next afternoon, March 4th, he came home from school to find a letter from Amy sitting in the mailbox. "Dear Archie," it said, "a big kiss to you on your birthday. Soon, my sweetheart, sooner and sooner and sooner, as long as you're still interested. I've done my best not to think about you, but it hasn't worked. Such a chilly winter it's been, living in this room with the windows open. I'm freezing. Love, Amy." Not knowing what soon meant, much less sooner and sooner and sooner, Ferguson couldn't quite make sense of what Amy had written, although the tone of the letter seemed encouraging. He was tempted to respond with a gushing letter of his own, but then he decided to wait until the question of college had been settled, which wouldn't happen until the middle of next month. On the other hand, if Amy sent another letter before then, he would write back at once. But she didn't, and the standoff continued. Ferguson imagined he was being strong, but later on, when he looked back on his actions from the perspective of his future self, he understood that he was merely being stubborn. Stubbornly proud, which was finally just another term for stupid. On March 7th, 200 Alabama state troopers attacked 525 civil rights demonstrators in Selma as they were preparing to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge and begin a march toward Montgomery to protest voting rights discrimination. Forever after, that date would be remembered as Bloody Sunday. The next morning, U.S. Marines landed in Vietnam. The two battalions, which had been sent to protect the air base at Da Nang, were the first combat forces to be posted in the country. U.S. personnel in Vietnam was now up to 23,000. By late July, the number would be increased to 125,000, and draft quotas would be doubled. On March 11th, the Reverend James J. Reeb of Boston, Massachusetts, was beaten to death in Selma. Two other white Unitarian ministers were injured in the attack. 6 days later, a local judge ruled that the march from Selma to Montgomery could proceed. President Johnson federalized the state National Guard, and after he sent in another 2,200 troops to protect the demonstrators, the walk began on March 21st. That same evening, Viola Liozzo, a mother of five from Detroit, who had driven down to Alabama to take part in the action, was shot to death in her car by members of the Ku Klux Klan because a black man was sitting next to her in the front seat. On Monday, March 22nd, a distraught, bewildered Ferguson began working for the Montclair Times again. A month had gone by since the end of the basketball season, and now it was time for baseball, dreaded, beautiful baseball, which would be an entirely different proposition from covering basketball, so much so that Ferguson had initially thought he wouldn't be up to doing it. But not writing for the paper had been hard on him. He had missed reporting on the games in the way a smoker misses cigarettes when the pack runs out. And the extra time he had been given to work on his poems had not produced any poems worth mentioning. Nothing but a string of failed poems that had so discouraged him that he was beginning to question whether he had any gift for poetry at all. And now that he was 14 months removed from the accident and a full season removed from any involvement with baseball, perhaps the moment had come to test himself and see whether he could walk back onto a ball field without tumbling into a funk of useless sorrows and regrets. There would be the excitement of high-speed electric riding, he told himself. There would be the fun of watching Bobby George swat balls over the fence and of talking to the big league scouts who would surely be coming around to look at Bobby. And as long as he could endure not being part of it anymore, there would be the old sensations of smelling the cut grass and looking up at white balls darting across blue skies and hearing the sounds of balls colliding with bats and leather gloves. And those things he would welcome, he thought, would welcome because he had missed them so much. And therefore, without once sharing his qualms with Imhoff, he kept to the bargain they had struck in December and went into Sal Martino's office on March 22nd to interview the coach about the upcoming season, which turned into the first of 21 articles he wrote that spring about the Montclair High School varsity baseball team. It wasn't as difficult as he had thought it would be. In fact, it wasn't difficult at all. And when the season opened with an away game at Columbia High School in early April, Ferguson drove there thinking less about the game that would be played that afternoon than the words he would use to write about it. He felt infinitely older than he had felt a year ago. So much older than anyone else's age, especially the boys on the team, which would have been his team as well if not for the accident. And just to prove how thoroughly things had changed for him, when he dropped off his Impala at Krolik's garage for a tune-up the following week and rode on the team bus to another away game in East Orange, he sat up front with Sal Martino rather than with his classmates in the back, for the boisterous, wisecracking, and loud laughter of the boys had lost its appeal to him. And suddenly one more childish thing had been put behind him. And it was strange to feel so old, he said to himself. Strange because it made him feel both sad and glad at the same time, which was a new emotion for him, something unprecedented in the history of his emotional life, sadness and gladness merging into a single mountain of feeling. And once that image occurred to him, he found himself thinking about the White Rock girl on the seltzer bottle and his conversation with Aunt Mildred about Psyche 6 years ago, when they had discussed the transformation of caterpillars into butterflies. But the puzzling thing about turning from the one into the other was that caterpillars were probably quite content to be caterpillars, creeping over the earth without once thinking about becoming something else. And sad as it must have been for them to stop being caterpillars, surely it was better and altogether astonishing to start over again as butterflies. Even if the life of a butterfly was more precarious and sometimes lasted just a single day. In the first 5 games of the season, the lovesick Bobby George hit 4 doubles, 3 home runs, and had a .632 average with 5 walks and 8 runs batted in. Whatever Margaret O'Mara had done to the poor boy's heart, she hadn't affected his ability to play baseball. "And just think," a scout for the Minnesota Twins said to Ferguson as he watched Bobby throw out a runner at second base, "the kid won't be 18 until the summer." On April 16th, Ferguson finally sat down and wrote a short letter to Amy. "I'm in," he began. "Columbia has accepted me as a member of the class of 69, a deliciously evocative number that seems to suggest all sorts of exciting activities in the future. Unlike you, I haven't made any effort not to think about you, but have kept you in mind steadily and lovingly, and sometimes despondently, for the past 4.5 months. So yes, in reply to your rhetorical question, I am still interested and will always be interested and will never not be interested because I love you madly and cannot bear to think of living my life without you. Please tell me when it will be possible to see you again. Your Archie. She didn't bother to write this time, but called him at home just hours after she had received the letter. And the first thing that struck him was how good it was to hear her voice again, her New York voice with the softened R's that turned his name into something that sounded like Archie. And an instant later, she was repeating the last sentence of his note, saying, "When will it be possible to see me?" To which he said, "That's right, when?" And out came the answer he had been hoping she would give him. "Anytime you like. Anytime, starting now." And so the banished Ferguson once again found himself in the good graces of his temperamental queen. And because she judged him to have behaved nobly during his exile, with no begging letters or phone calls, no whining exhortations to be reinstated to his former position at court, the first words she said to him when he drove into New York to see her the following night were, "You're my one and only, Archie. My one in a million, one and only." And because she started to cry the moment he put his arms around her, Ferguson suspected that life had been somewhat rocky for her in the past 4.5 months, that there were things she felt ashamed of having done, no doubt things concerning sex, and for that reason he decided not to ask her any questions, not then and not ever, for he didn't want to hear about the other people she had slept with and have to imagine her naked body in bed with another naked body sporting a long, fat erection that was traveling into the space between her parted legs. No names or descriptions, please, not one detail of any kind. And since he didn't ask her any of the questions she must have been expecting him to ask, she clung to him all the more tightly because of that. It was the most beautiful spring of his life, the spring of being with Amy again, of having Amy to talk to again, of holding the naked Amy in his arms again, of listening to Amy blast forth against Johnson and the CIA for shipping 20,000 soldiers down to the Dominican Republic to stop the freely elected writer-historian Juan Bosch from reclaiming the presidency because he was supposedly under the influence of the communists, which was untrue. And why meddle in that little country's business when America was already doing so much damage in other parts of the world? How Ferguson admired her for the purity of her indignation, and how satisfying it was to be spending the weekends with her in New York again, which in a few short months would be where he lived as well. And beyond Amy, the spring was beautiful because his worries about next year were at last behind him, which meant he could slack off for the first time in all the years he had been in school, just as everyone else in the senior class was slacking off during those 2 months of dolce far poco, which had somehow reduced ancient conflicts and animosities and seemed to be drawing everyone closer together as the end of their lives together approached. And then, as the weather warmed up, there was the new ritual he established with his father, the two of them waking at 6 o'clock every weekday morning and leaving the house by 6:30 for an hour or an hour and a half of tennis on the empty public courts in town, his 51-year-old father, still able to beat him in every set by scores of 6-2 and 6-3. But the exercise was putting Ferguson back in shape, and after a long stretch of no sports since the day of the crack-up, the tennis was fulfilling an old and still powerful need in him, and he was glad to see his father win, glad to see how painless it was for the old man to be dismantling his store, selling off the remaining stock of TVs, radios, and air conditioners for 1/3 off, 1/2 off, 2/3 off. The struggle was over now. His father no longer cared about anything. All his former ambitions had vanished into thin air. And with his mother in the process of dismantling her own business as well, each of them scheduled to vacate by May 30th and start their new jobs in mid-June, there was something giddy about them that spring, giddy in the way small, exuberant children could be when someone grabbed hold of their ankles and turned them upside down, as he and Amy must have been when they bounced naked on the bed together during those blacked-out moments of the distant past, at how lucky it was that even after his mother had given the Montclair Times notice of her impending departure, Imhoff hadn't sacked him out of revenge. So Ferguson was continuing to cover the twice-weekly baseball games of the Montclair varsity. And with Bobby George on his way to a first-team All-State season and most likely a contract with a major league club, Ferguson was impressed by how well Bobby was handling his newfound stardom, which had made him the talk of the school. And even though he was still battling with his studies and couldn't resist laughing at unfunny jokes about farmers' daughters and traveling salesmen, there was a new aura of greatness around him, which was slowly beginning to seep into Bobby and change how he thought about himself. And now that Margaret O'Mara had started talking to him, one seldom saw Bobby walking around without a smile on his face. The same sweet smile Ferguson remembered from their days together as 4- and 5-year-old boys. One of the best things about that beautiful spring was anticipating the summer, making plans with Amy for the trip they were going to take to France, a month-long journey from the middle of July to the middle of August. 1 month, because that was all they could afford, after stitching together money saved from past summer jobs, the fees from Ferguson's Montclair Times articles that had not been spent on gas for his car and hamburgers for his stomach, a sizable graduation present from Ferguson's grandfather, $500, a smaller contribution from Amy's paternal grandfather, and additional sums chipped in by both sets of parents, which would cover 4.5 weeks of bare-bones living once the fares for the charter flight had been dispensed with. So rather than try to cram a grand European tour into that limited amount of time, they chose to stick to one country and immerse themselves in it as fully as they could. France was the inevitable choice, because they were both studying French and wanted to become more fluent in the language, but also because France was the center of all things that were not American, with the best poets, the best novelists, the best filmmakers, the best philosophers, the best museums, and the best food. And with no luggage but the knapsacks on their backs, they left American soil from Kennedy Airport at 8 o'clock in the evening on July 15th, one day after the annual celebration of Bastille Day in France. It was their first trip abroad. For Ferguson, it was also the first time he had flown in an airplane, which meant it was the first time he had ever lost contact with the earth. Paris, for the most part, Paris for 22 of the 31 days they spent in France, with one excursion by train to the north, Normandy and Brittany, with visits to Omaha Beach, Mont-Saint-Michel, and Chateaubriand's family castle in Saint-Malo, and one excursion to the south, Marseille, Arles, Avignon, and Nîmes. A vow to converse in French with each other as often as possible, to shun American tourists, to strike up conversations with local residents in order to practice their French, to read only French books and newspapers, to see only French films, to send home postcards written in French. The Paris hotel they lived in was so obscure that it didn't even have a name. The sign above the front door simply read, Hotel. And the simple room they shared on the Rue Clément in the 6th arrondissement, directly facing the Marché Saint-Germain, the small but large enough Chambre 18, which had no telephone or television or radio in it, which was equipped with a cold water sink but no toilet, cost 10 francs a night, the equivalent of $2, which came to $1 apiece. And what difference did it make that the toilet down the hall wasn't always free when you wanted to use it, or that the shower was a cramped metal box jammed into the wall at the top of the stairs and wasn't always free when you wanted to use it? The essential thing was that the room was clean and light and that the bed was big enough for two people to sleep in it comfortably. And even more essential was the fact that the owner of the hotel, a stout man with a mustache named Antoine, could not have cared less that Ferguson and Amy were sharing that bed, even though they were clearly not married and were young enough to have been Antoine's children. That was the first thing that endeared them to France, the blessed indifference to the private lives of others. But more things soon followed, such as the hard-to-understand fact that everything seemed to smell better in Paris than in New York. not just the bakeries and restaurants and cafes, but even the nethermost bowels of the metro, where the disinfectant used to wash down the floors was scented with something akin to perfume, whereas the New York subways were rank and often unbreathable, and the constant motion of the sky, with clouds continually massing overhead and then breaking apart, which created a shimmering, mutating sort of light that was both soft and full of surprises. And the northern latitude that kept the midsummer sky aglow for many more hours than at home, still not dark until 10:30 or 10:45 at night, and the pleasure of simply wandering through the streets, of being lost and yet never fully lost, as in the streets of the village in New York, but now an entire city was like the village, with no grid and few right angles in the neighborhoods they went to, as one sinuous cobbled path wound around and flowed into another. And of course there was the food, la cuisine française, rapturously ingested at the one restaurant meal they had every night, after a breakfast of buttered bread and coffee, tartine beurrée and café crème, and a lunch of homemade ham sandwiches, jambon de Paris, or homemade cheese sandwiches, gruyère, camembert, emmental, nightly dinners at the good but inexpensive restaurants noted in Europe on $5 a day, and at places such as Le Restaurant des Beaux-Arts and Vadja in Montparnasse and La Crèmerie Polidor, supposedly one of James Joyce's eating spots. They dug into foods and dishes they had never encountered in New York or anywhere else. Poireaux vinaigrette, rillettes, escargot, céleri remoulade, coco vin, pot-au-feu, quenelle, bavette, cassoulet, fraises au crème chantilly, and the beguiling sugar bomb known as baba au rhum. Within a week of setting foot in Paris, they had turned into rabid Francophiles, with Amy suddenly announcing her decision to major in French, as she worked her way through novels by Flaubert and Stendhal, and Ferguson made his first halting attempts to translate French poetry, as he sat in Chambre 18, or the back room at La Palette, and read Apollinaire, Éluard, Desnos, and other pre-war French poets for the first time. Needless to say, there were moments when they quarreled and got on each other's nerves, for they were together nearly every second for 31 days and nights, and Amy was a person prone to the occasional storm and foul-mouthed snit, and Ferguson had a tendency to lapse into fugues of morose introspection and/or inexplicable silences. But none of their disagreements lasted more than an hour or two, and most, if not all of them, occurred while they were on the road, under the duress of travel and sleepless nights on trains. Needless to say as well, America was constantly on their minds throughout the trip, even if they were glad to be away from it for the time being. And they talked at length about the two encouraging things that happened while they were gone, Johnson signing the Medicare bill on July 30th, and then the Voting Rights Act on August 6th, and also about the calamitous thing that happened on August 11th, just 5 days before they flew home. The race riots in Los Angeles, the rage riots of the black population in a neighborhood called Watts. After which Amy said, "Forget about studying French. My first impulse was the right one all along, history and political science." To which Ferguson raised an imaginary glass and said, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask Amy Schneiderman to run your country." The day before they were scheduled to return to New York, they made two embarrassing discoveries. One, they had bought too many books to carry on the plane. Two, their money was precariously low, no doubt because buying books had not been factored into their budget. They had both lost weight during their month abroad, Ferguson 7 pounds, Amy 5 pounds, but that was to be expected of people determined to subsist on only one full meal a day. And yet, in spite of those economies, they had overspent on their frequent visits to bookstores, mostly to the Librairie Gallimard across from l'Église Saint-Germain, and to the shop run by left-wing publisher François Maspero across from l'Église Saint-Séverin, and in addition to the 21 volumes of poetry Ferguson had bought and the 11 thick novels Amy had bought, They had been unable to resist purchasing a number of political books by Frantz Fanon, Les Damnés de la Terre, Paul Nizan, Aden Arabi, and Jean-Paul Sartre, Situation 1, 2, 3, which increased the total to 37 books. Several hours of their last day in Paris were therefore squandered on packing up those books in cartons, lugging them to the post office, and shipping them to Amy's apartment on West 111th Street. All of them to Amy's apartment, even the ones that belonged to Ferguson, because his parents had accepted a down payment on their house in early June, and it was unclear whether they were still living in Montclair or had moved somewhere else by now. And the cost of the stamps required to send those cartons across the ocean by slow boat, with delivery expected sometime around Christmas, so depleted their remaining cash that they were left with just $14, eight of which would be needed for the bus ride to the airport in the morning. Their plans for a large farewell meal at the Restaurant des Beaux-Arts that evening were consequently destroyed, and they were reduced to dining on flat, desiccated hamburgers at the Wimpy's on Boulevard Saint-Michel. Fortunately, they both found it funny, for bad planning on that scale proved that they were indeed the most ridiculous people on earth. So the skinny, bedraggled 18-year-olds returned from their Gallic adventures, hobbling into the New York air terminal with their overloaded backpacks and bushy heads of hair. And once they had gone through passport control and customs, their parents opened their arms and welcomed them back, greeting them with an enthusiasm and intensity normally reserved for returning war heroes and discoverers of new continents. Amy and Ferguson, who had already arranged to meet up again in a couple of days, kissed each other goodbye, and then they marched off with their respective families to be driven home for baths, haircuts, and brief visits with their parents, grandparents, and aunts and uncles. As Ferguson quickly learned while walking to the car, home was no longer the house in Montclair, but an apartment in the Weequahic section of Newark. Neither one of his parents seemed upset by this backward move out of the suburbs. This apparent fall in social status, or economic status, or worldly status, or any other measure of what constituted success or failure in American life, which relieved him of the obligation to feel upset on their behalf, for the truth was that he didn't care one way or the other. His mother was laughing. "Not only are we back in Newark," she said, "but we're in the same building we used to live in when we were first married, 25 Van Velsor Place. Not the same apartment, but one on the same floor, the third floor, right across the hall from where you spent the first 3 years of your life. Pretty extraordinary, don't you think? I wonder if you'll remember anything about it. An identical apartment, Archie. Not the same one, but one just like it." An hour later, when Ferguson stepped into the two-bedroom flat on the third floor of 25 Van Velsor Place, he was impressed by how cozy and lived in it felt after such a short time. In just 3 weeks, his parents had already managed to settle in, and compared to the narrow confines of Chambre 18, its proportions struck him as immense. Nothing like the house in Montclair, of course, but big enough. "Well, Archie," his mother said, as he wandered in and out of the rooms, "does anything come back to you?" Ferguson wished he could have thought of some clever remark to echo the hopefulness in his mother's voice, but all he could do was shake his head and smile. He remembered nothing.